This is EastEnding. Tonight, we celebrate Black History Month with the work of African-American writers, presented by members of the Sag Harbor community. The reading was produced by the John Germain Library, the Eastville Community Historical Society, and Catios Cultural Cafe, all of Sag Harbor. To begin, Eva Iacona reads Jesmyn Ward's Men We Reaped, a memoir.
We who still live do what we must. Life is a hurricane, and we board up to save what we can and bow low to the earth, to crouch in that small space above the dirt where the wind will not reach. We honor anniversaries of deaths by cleaning graves and sitting next to them before fires, sharing food with those who will not eat again. We raise children and tell them other things about who they can be and what they are worth. To us, everything. We love each other fiercely while we live and after we die. We survive. We are savages. When I was 12 years old, I looked in the mirror and I saw what I perceived to be my faults and my mother's faults. These coalesced into a dark mark that I would carry through my life, a loathing of what I saw, which came from others' hatred of me. And all this fostered a hatred of myself. I thought being unwanted and abandoned and persecuted was the legacy of the poor Southern Black woman. But as an adult, I see my mother's legacy anew. I see how all the burdens she bore, the burdens of her history and identity and our country's history and identity, enabled her to manifest her greatest gifts. My mother had the courage to look at four hungry children and find a way to fill them. My mother had the strength to work her body to its breaking point to provide for herself and her children. My mother had the resilience to cobble together a family from the broken bits of another. And my mother's example teaches me other things. This is how a transplanted people survived the Holocaust and slavery. This is how Black people in the South organized to vote under the shadow of terrorism and the noose. This is how human beings sleep and wake and fight and survive. In the end, this is how a mother teaches her daughter to have courage, to have strength, to be resilient, to open her eyes to what is, and to make something of it. As the eldest daughter of an eldest daughter, and having just born a daughter, I hope to teach my child these lessons, to pass on my mother's gifts. Without my mother's legacy, I would never have been able to look at this history of loss, this future where I will surely lose more, and write that the narrative that remembers, write the narrative that says, hello, we are here, listen, it is not easy, I continue. Sometimes I am tireless, and sometimes I am weary. And when I am weary, I imagine this. After the moment I die, I will find myself standing on the side of a long, pitted asphalt road, flanked on both sides by murmuring pine trees under a hot, high sun in a blue sky. In the distance, I will hear a rumbling, thumping, a bass beat. A dull blue 85 Cutlass will cut the horizon, come growling down the road before stopping in front of me. It will stop so quickly, the gravel will crunch, and then my brother will swing the passenger door wide with one long tattooed arm and other on the wheel. He will look at me with his large, dark, liquid eyes, his face soft. He will know that I have been waiting. He will say, come. Come take a ride with me. I will, brother. I'm here.
This is East End Inc. Continuing with the read-in of African-American writers, here's Christine Kendall reading her story, Peepers.
My five-year-old son finds a way to climb up the outside wall of our bungalow so he can peek into the kitchen. His short brown fingers clutch the window frame as his curly hair rises up into the space above the sill. When finally his eyes appear behind the screen, there's laughter in them, but I yell at him to get down. Right now, I say. He ignores me and swivels his head from left to right, taking in the full measure of our small place. Are you deaf? I shout, an unfamiliar heat rising up into my face. I scratch at my 3-day-old beard, but I know that's not the cause of my discomfort. My shouting draws Maya into our usually quiet little kitchen. Her wide eyes gently search my face, but her back stiffens when she sees our boy in the window. How long has it been? Over 4 years since I cut through our backyard on my way home from work and found a man pressed up against that same wall peeking into our house. We didn't have kitchen curtains then, and he could easily see Maya seated at the old wooden table feeding our newborn. My son's lips were clasped around the dark nipple of her caramel breasts that protruded from her unbuttoned white blouse. You're wrong, man. Screaming, I picked up a stick and ran toward the red-faced thug, but he heard me coming and took off down my neighbor's driveway. Maya cried when I told her what happened. She couldn't bear the thought that the man may have watched her before. For me, the hardest part was him getting away. I'd wanted to cut loose on him, pound his head against the aluminum siding, draw some blood. But that's not what happened. The man tore down the driveway, turning over 2 empty trash cans as he went. I took the first one like an Olympic hurdler, but got all tangled up in the second one, slamming down hard on the asphalt. I struggled to my feet and limped to the curb, but the guy had already disappeared down the street. Now, our son's questioning eyes dart back and forth between his mother and me. He's kneeling on a chair, Maya says, gesturing at our boy. He won't get hurt. My son giggles and grins, but all I want to do is close the curtains. Maya pats my arm before stepping out into the backyard and sitting on the seat of the garden chair with our only child, their bodies fitting together as if they were made that way. They peer through the screen and make goo-goo eyes at me, at our little house and everything in it. My jaw slackens as I lean against the wall. I raise the window screen and cup each of their pointing little chins in one of my big hands.
Next here is Jennifer Morgan reading from her work about Elizabeth Key from the collection 400 Souls, a community history of African America from 1619 to 2019.
In 1662 in Virginia, there was a law passed that said that the condition of children born to African women would follow the status of their mothers, not their fathers. It's a really important law that defines what racial slavery is going to mean in all of the Americas. So that's the starting point. As a child, Elizabeth Key found herself misidentified, called outside her name. At some point in the late 1620s, a free white Englishman and member of the Virginia House of Burgesses named Thomas Key had impregnated Elizabeth's enslaved African-born mother. What her mother, who was never actually named and who was only called woman slave in the records, hoped or believed about her daughter's future is utterly lost. What is clear is that Thomas Key's death threw her future, Elizabeth's future, into some confusion. Although she had been placed in an indenture, not enslaved, as a child, after his death, she was sold to another Virginia landowner. Now, selling the remaining terms of an indenture was not uncommon, but because she was the daughter of an African woman, her race made her vulnerable to abuses that an English woman would have been protected from. Although they had embraced the system of African slavery elsewhere in the Atlantic, in Virginia, the English were still relying mostly on indentured servants, the vast majority of whom were English themselves. In the 1650s, there were fewer than 300 Africans in the colony, or about 1% of the population of English settlers. And yet, Elizabeth understood that she was in danger and that her color could dictate her status. Now, her status as Thomas Key's daughter was never a secret. It was widely known that this young woman's father was a free Englishman. We learned from a witness at the trial that would ensue that out of ignorance or spite, Thomas Key's other child, John, had called Elizabeth Black Bess. The overseer's wife checked him and said, "Sir, you must call her sister, for she is your sister." In other words, Elizabeth was widely acknowledged to be Thomas Key's daughter. Now, whether or not the overseer's wife was meant to take John down a peg, it was recognition of Elizabeth's lineage. But her relative freedom, pinned as it was to a transgressive paternity, was not sufficient. So, in order to protect herself and her son in 1655 at the age of 25, Elizabeth Key petitioned in the court for her freedom, and she became the first woman of African descent to do so in the North American English colonies. While we know very little about her, we can be confident that she had a precise understanding of the dangers that surrounded her as a result of the consequences of race and sex in colonial Virginia. She had, at this time, been transferred to a third Englishman. Remember, she was never enslaved. She was put into an indenture. But by then, a third man claimed to own her and listed her among her Negroes rather than his servants. She had been, at that time, held for at least 10 years longer than the terms of her 1636 indenture. Her freedom was granted, it was then overturned, and finally, when she brought her case to the General Assembly, it was conferred. At that point, she and her common-law husband posted their intention to marry, and she and her descendants remained legally free well into the 18th century. But importantly, less than 6 years later, the Virginia Assembly revisited this case, perhaps understanding that granting freedom to the children of women raped by free property-owning Englishmen would fundamentally undermine the system of slavery that they relied on. And so it was at this moment in 1662 that they decreed that the condition of a child born to an African woman, no matter who the father was, would follow that woman into slavery. This was a piece of legislation that encapsulated the early understanding of racial slavery, the understanding that it was a category of labor, that to be Black was to have a condition, a category of labor imposed upon you that African people, only African people, and their descendants would always inherit.
We continue with the 2022 Afro-American Writers Read-In, recorded this month in Sag Harbor. Here is Tom Oleschuk reading A World of Daughters by Yusuf Komunyakaa.
A World of Daughters. Say, lick clean at birth. Say, weeping in the tall grass where this tantalizing song begins. Birds paused on a crooked branch over a grave of an unending trek into the valley of cooling waters. Lessons of earth, old questions unmoor the first tongue. Say I've gone back, says the oracle, counting seasons and centuries, undoing fault lines between one generation and next, as she twirls sackcloth edged with pollen, and one glimpses what one did not know. Say, this is where the goat was asked to speak legends ago, to kneel and deliver a sacrifice. To feel a truth depends on how and why the singer's song fits into the mouth. Well, I believe the borrowed rib story is the other way round, entangled in decree, blessing, law, and myth. One only has to listen to night-long pleas of a mother who used all 1,000 chants and prayers of clay, red ochre, blown from the mouth upon the high stone wall, retracing a final land bridge to wishbone. My own two daughters and granddaughter, the three know how to work praise and lament, ready to sprout wings of naked flight and labor. Yes, hinged into earth, we rose from Lucy to clan, from clan to tribe. And today we worship her sun-polished bones, remembering she is made of questions, No, mama is not always a first word before counting eggs in the cowbird's nest. It begins in memory. Now say her name. Say Dinknesh, mother of us all.
Next, Heidi Rain reads The Conceit by Maya Angelou.
Give me your hand. Make room for me to lead and follow you beyond this rage of poetry. Let others have the privacy of touching words and love of loss of love. For me, give me your hand.
Continuing the Black Writers read-in, here are Rebecca Chapman and Tippi Fortune reading the poetry of Langston Hughes.
Mother to son? Well, son, I'll tell you. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it and splinters and boards torn up and places with no carpet on the floor bare. But all the time I've been a-climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So boy, don't you turn back. Don't you set down on the steps because you finds it kind of hard. Don't you fall now, for I's still going, honey. I's still climbing, and life for me ain't been no crystal stair.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood and human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. Dream variations. To fling my arms wide in some place in the sun, to whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree while night comes on gently, dark like me. That is my dream. To fling my arms wide in the face of the sun, dance, whirl, whirl till the quick day is done, rest at pale evening a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me. I too sing, America. I'm the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America. And then the last one is called Harlem. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?
Finally, on this 2022 Black Writers Read-In, here is Bill Chaliff reading from the 1619 Project, a section written by Nicole Hannah-Jones.
As the sociologist Glenn Bracey writes, out of the ashes of white degradation, we gave birth to ourselves. For as much as white people tried to pretend, black people were not chattel. And so the process of seasoning, instead of erasing identity, served an opposite purpose. In the void, we forged a new culture, all our own. Today, our very manner of speaking recalls the Creole language that enslaved people innovated to communicate with both Africans who used various dialects and the English-speaking people who enslaved them. Our style of dress, the defining flair, stems from the desires of enslaved people shorn of all individuality to assert their own identity. enslaved people would wear the hat in a jaunty manner, or knot a head scarf intricately. Today's avant-garde nature of Black hairstyles and fashion displays a vibrant reflection of enslaved people's determination to feel fully human through self-expression. The improvisational quality of Black art and music comes from a culture that ejected and rejected convention in order to cope with constant disruption. Black naming practices, so often impugned by mainstream society, are themselves an act of resistance. Our last names often derive from the white people who were once owned us. That is why the insistence of many Black Americans, particularly those most marginalized, to give our children names that we create that are neither European nor are from Africa, a place we have never been, is an act of self-determination. When the world listens to quintessentially American music, it is our voice they hear. The sorrow songs we sang in the field to soothe our physical pain and find hope in a freedom we did not expect to know until we died became American gospel. Amid the devastating violence and poverty of the Mississippi Delta, we birthed jazz and the blues, and it was in the deeply impoverished and segregated neighborhoods where white Americans forced the descendants of the enslaved to live, that teenagers too poor to buy instruments used old records to create a new music known as hip hop. Our speech and fashion and the drum of our music echo Africa, but are more than African. Out of our unique isolation, both from our native cultures and from white America, we forge this nation's most significant original culture. In turn, mainstream society has coveted our style, our slang, and our song, seeking to appropriate the one truly American culture as its own. As Langston Hughes wrote in 1926, "They'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America." For centuries, white Americans have been trying to solve the Negro problem. They have dedicated thousands of pages to this endeavor. It is common still to point to rates of Black poverty, out of wedlock births, crime, and college attendance, as if these conditions in a country built on racial, caste, and color systems are not utterly predictable. But crucially, you cannot view those statistics while ignoring another, that Black people were enslaved here longer than we have been free. As a woman in my 40s, I am part of the first generation of Black Americans in the history of the United States to be born into a society in which Black people had full rights of citizenship. Black people suffered under slavery for 250 years. We have been legally free for just 50. Yet in that briefest of spans, despite continuing to face rampant discrimination, and despite there never having been a genuine effort to redress the wrongs of slavery and the century of racial apartheid that followed, Black Americans have made astounding progress, not only for ourselves, but also for all Americans. What if America understood finally now at the dawn of its fifth century that we have never been the problem, but the solution? When I was a child, I must have been in fifth or sixth grade, a teacher gave our class an assignment intended to celebrate the diversity of the great American melting pot. she instructed each of us to write a short report on our ancestral land and then draw that nation's flag. As she turned to write the assignment on the board, the other Black girl in class locked eyes with me. Slavery had erased my connection we had to an African country. And even if we tried to claim the whole continent, there was no African flag. It was hard enough being one of two Black kids in the class, and this assignment would be just another reminder of the distance between the white kids and us. In the end, I walked over to the globe near my teacher's desk, picked a crayon up, picked a random African country, and claimed it as my own. I wish now that I could go back to the younger me and tell her people's ancestry started here, on these lands, and to boldly, proudly draw the stars and stripes of the American flag. We were told once by virtue of our bondage that we could never be American, but it was by virtue of our bondage that we became the most American of all.
This is East End Inc. We heard East End community members reading the work of African American writers. The program was produced by the John Germain Library, the Eastville Community Historical Society, and Canio's Cultural Cafe, all of Sag Harbor. The complete reading is available at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. Upcoming literary events on the East End include, on Saturday, February 26th at 5, John Steinbeck's 120th birthday celebration on Zoom. Steinbeck scholar Susan Schillinglaw talks about the Nobel Prize-winning author who lived in Sag Harbor. Details are at canios.wordpress.com. Click on Events. East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasional 5th Wednesday at this time. The programs are archived at moreeastendinc.blogspot.com. And the podcasts are at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. Today's East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Kelly Harris and Catherine Soka.